Hello, everyone, and welcome to The Hidden Lives of Writers. My name's Fiona Snickers, and I'm joined by my co-host, Gail Schimmel.
Hi, Fiona. How are you doing?
All good, all good. Gail, how has your writing week been?
It's been interesting. I have been in a bit of a slump. I have been a bit unable to write, and I had to give myself a talking to, pull myself together. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I've realized is I have a project that I have to get off my desk. It's now acting, it's looming like a cloud over me. It's stopping me doing other things. Mm-hmm. I have to get that project off my desk. So this week I've been working very, very hard on doing the last bits of that project, getting it done. And then what really was lovely is I've been wanting for a while to try writing a play. Mm-hmm. And I haven't had an idea. And I've had the idea, and I've had it in that way that sometimes the magic of creativity works, that the whole idea is there except for a little bit in the middle. And I know how it must begin and end that brings it together. And I can't wait to start writing that, even though I should be writing my book that I'm writing. But I'm excited about writing. So it's been good.
Do you know how to write a play?
Not
because a clue. I'm not sure that I do.
Not a clue. So I asked a friend how many words should be in a 1 hour play. Mm-hmm. And then I reckon I can figure out the rest and then show it to someone who knows and go, okay, what do I need to do to bash this into shape? Like, I understand that you have to write stage directions, and I understand that it has to break down into pieces, and you've got to be clear about how those pieces are. And now I understand that for an hour I need 10,000 words. And I'm just going to run with it because it's so clear in my head that I'll run with it and then I'll fix it.
Okay. I like that plan.
What about you, Fiona?
I still have my novel sitting in a drawer and I've been concentrating.
Is it not getting a bit moldy now?
It might need to come out and breathe and see the light of day soon. But in the meanwhile, I've been doing some academic writing, and I'm having to get clear in my mind the difference between blog writing and academic writing. Because last week, Kaya Dlanger mentioned that he used to write for the Mail and Guardian's Thought Leader, which I did as well, which gave one a tremendous amount of freedom. You basically just slapped your ideas and opinions down on the page, and nobody really took you up on them, and you didn't have to cite everything you said. Mm. So I've been wanting to write that South Africa is a very unequal society, which I think most people would agree with. But in an academic context, you need to have a citation for that. You need to prove that it's a very unequal society. And having to stop myself every step of the way and think, wait a minute, what is my actual source for saying that?
And wait a minute, is it actually true?
Is it true?
We know it's true, but
how true is it? Who's the most reliable person who has proved that it's true? So it's just a rewiring of the brain kind of thing to get into academic writing rather than just slapping an opinion down. So
very
that's been a bit of a learning curve.
That's very interesting, and possibly why I will never do another degree.
Well, you've got enough already. Gail, what have you been reading or watching or listening to lately?
So I have just read the new Jojo Moyes, and I know she is what some people would label a guilty pleasure in reading. I don't think so. I think she's magnificent. Also, I don't believe in guilty pleasures, but I really, it's interesting for me. So I've read, the book is called We All Live Here, and it's a woman in her, I'm not going to get it wrong, I think she's in her 40s, and her life has kind of imploded. It's wonderful. She's written a book about how to sustain a wonderful marriage, and then her husband promptly leaves her for another woman, for his bendy mistress, who is another school mom.
Oh.
And she has to see this woman at pickup every day. And she has, at the beginning of the book, her stepfather is living with her because her mother has recently died. So that's another layer. Her stepfather's living with her. And then during the book, her biological father arrives, and you have these two grumpy old men, and it's just comedy genius. And it's a lovely, gentle book about the characters mostly. It doesn't have a massive plot. It's got a gentle plot. It's about these interesting characters. It's a lot of fun. I enjoyed it so much. What I found very interesting is I posted a review about it on a Facebook page that we're going to talk about a lot today. And I found the feedback was quite interestingly like in the guilty pleasure variety. Yes, this is a good light read.
Okay, but
let,
yes.
That kind of like, let me step away from this and make it clear. I don't think it's literary.
Mm.
And it's just interesting the way we feel this need to slightly put down a book that's just enjoyable because it's enjoyable.
Mm.
Very interesting. But I loved it. We All Live Here by Jojo Moyes. Highly recommend.
Well, you've sold me. I'm going to give it a try. I wasn't sure. But now I am sure.
I think you'll love it. What have you been reading, watching, listening to?
So for the first time in my life, I am getting into audiobooks.
Ooh.
And you recently said that we need to have no guilt about how we consume our stories, whether we're watching it, listening to it, or reading it on the page. So I have been listening to books while also continuing to read books. But I just realized that there was a time in my day when I'm not listening to podcasts, I'm not reading anything, and I'm not watching anything, but I do have time to listen to something that maybe is not yet another podcast.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been filling that, weirdly enough, with Dickens. And the advantage of Dickens is that you can really put your brain into cruise mode.
Okay.
You know that you've got a lot to listen to. You're not going to get through this in a hurry. They are normally so well performed by these kind of BBC voice actors who are absolute geniuses. You can normally pick them up for 99 cents, which for 38 hours worth of an audiobook is an incredibly good deal. And there are quite a few Dickens books that I haven't read yet. So I'm filling up my education by listening to Dickens. I'm looking forward to it. I'm enjoying it. And I think this is going to be the start of my audiobook revolution.
And you can feel morally superior about it because it's Dickens. So it's not a guilty pleasure. It's a fine intellectual endeavor.
Well, I think Dickens was the guilty pleasure of the 19th century, actually.
Isn't it interesting? Because he so was, because he wrote serialized novels that worked like soap operas.
Exactly, exactly. And actually, they still are. People can call him literary as much as they like. But he was just a guy who could tell a good yarn in 500,000 words or less.
And spat them out, right? Wrote prolifically. I mean, he's the Colleen Hoover of his day.
He really is. He really is. Well, Gail, you were talking about a certain Facebook group that is dedicated to books. And that reminds me to introduce our guest today. Our guest today is Paige Nick. Paige is the author of numerous novels, including Unprecedented, Dutch Courage, Death by Carbs, Pens Behaving Badly, which I think was not a novel, or was it?
Book of Columns. Yeah,
that's right. That's
Sunday
right.
Columns.
This Way Up, A Million Miles from Normal, and also a delightful series of erotica novels with Sarah Lotz and Helen Moffat, including A Girl Walks Into a Bar, A Girl Walks Into a Wedding, A Girl Walks Into a Blind Date. In her day job, Paige is a freelance advertising copywriter for which she has won numerous awards. Paige, we are so delighted to have you in the studio today. Hello and welcome.
So nice to be here.
Paige,
big fan of the show.
We have been so excited. We have been looking forward to this one. We've been gobbling the book up, and we are really, really thrilled to have you here.
When I was invited, I was like, at last, it's real, I'm a writer.
I don't know about that, because your writing career predates either of ours. If you listen to the show, you know where we're going right now. How has your writing week been?
Well, I've been up here in Jersey, which is a little distracting. And us writers, we love a distraction because it means that we don't have to write so much. I've had a bit of advertising writing that I do, and a couple of columns for book promotion. I'm busy with a draft on I've got a very dirty first draft of a novel, but I am not as deep in it as I should be because I'm distracted with book promo stuff.
And when you are not distracted and you're working flat out on a novel project, what does that daily process look like?
So when I'm writing that first draft, not into the edit, because the editing process for me is very different to the writing process.
Well, tell us about both. We
right.
want to hear it all.
So my day job, as you mentioned, is that I'm an advertising copywriter. I work in a team. So my day job, Monday to Friday and some weekends, is advertising, and then I squeeze the writing in between. So when I'm writing a novel, once I've had the idea and I've decided I'm going to write it, I become very obsessed with it, and I don't do anything else. So I'll do the things that I need to do, the day job, the run a book show on Fine Music Radio. So I'll do the things that I have to do. I don't read. I don't watch anything. I don't go out. I don't speak to very many people. I become very isolated, and I listen to the voices in my head, and I write as long as I can. I'll grab 10 minutes between meetings or work through lunch, or as soon as I finish my day job, I take a little break, go for a walk, and then I'll go back to the novel. So I'm very obsessive. I call myself Page No Friends, and I'm not fun at all, and nobody really likes me, and I'm fine with that. Just leave me alone. During the novel writing. So that'll be 2 months, about 2 months of very obsessive writing.
Okay, just stop there. 2 months.
For a first draft.
For a first draft.
It's the dirtiest, you know, like a dirty martini.
Yes.
It's the dirtiest first draft you've ever seen. So it'll be missing chapters. It'll be revolting. It's not funny in lots of places.
But your output must be extraordinary.
I just don't do anything else. Remember, I don't have children. I'm not married. I don't have pets. I have no responsibilities beyond the responsibilities that any adult human being has of earning a living, putting petrol in the car, exercising. I don't have to feed anyone. I don't have to shop for anyone. So my poor partner, Claudio, like I say, I'm not very nice to be around in that time, but it's all I want to do. I don't want to do anything else.
Thank you for trying to make us feel better, but still, 2 months. Jesus.
This isn't literary fiction. This is a really ugly, dirty draft of something. And then I send it to Helen and Sarah and say to them, is this even a thing? What is this a thing? And then they'll write back and go, yes, it needs an awful lot of work, but yes, it is maybe a thing. And then we start.
And then what does that look like?
So I don't love it as much. Like my like complete obsession is the enjoyable part, and the disappearing for hours and hours and not knowing where I am. And I can't hear anything. Claudio will come home and I don't even hear him coming home. And then he give me the fright of my life. He's suddenly behind me. But I'm not like that in the editing process. Yeah. I find that a bit more stilted. So I almost have to kind of get back into it. So I won't look at it for this one that I'm on now. I didn't look at it for 6 weeks after I'd finished the draft. Put it away somewhere. Don't look at it. Get some distance from that draft so that when you go back and read it, you can have a little bit of distance from it and see your errors, see how badly you've written something. And then I hit the edit, and I'm quite motivated and disciplined, only in my writing, in that I will work on it every single day, even if I only do 10 minutes. I can't let the days not working on it rack up, because then one day very easily becomes 2 days, very easily becomes 3 days, and then you don't have a book. And I did a writing course in 2010 for my first novel with Sarah Bullen. She said a few things that have stuck with me always, but the one thing she said is, you can have your TV show or you can have your novel. You can have your dinner out with friends, or you can have a novel. You can have a shopping excursion, or you can have a novel. And that rings in my head a lot, all the time. It's never gone out of my head. So if I feel like, oh, I really feel like reading, and I'm busy editing, I think you can have a book you've read, or you can have a novel. And that really does work for me. I also have an egg timer, one of those very large silly egg timers, and I use that a lot. I'll just go, if I'm not to get myself going, I'll go, I'm just going to do one egg timer, turn the egg timer, do it. Invariably, I'll carry on going, but it's a way in to, we all need a way in, you know, to stop what you're doing and actually go into the world you need to be in.
And sorry, I need to unpack this for my own motivation and education. You do it after hours. So you do your day job. You don't mix it up with your day job.
I do.
Do you?
So because I'm a freelancer, some days I'll have 3 clients. Some days I'll have 1 client. Some days I'll have no clients. Most days we have 1 client. But we work in our own time, Karen and I. She has 3 kids, a husband, 3 cats. We do tend to work very much in our own time. So if we've got a review at 2 o'clock, say we finish our work by 11 for that review, I've got from 11 till 2, and then I can dip in. So I'm always stealing hours. I generally finish my exercise and I'm at my desk by, say, 8, and Karen comes to her desk at 9, that's an hour. And so I'll do an hour then of whatever was in my head while I was running or swimming, I can get down. Mm. Or just transcribe what I voice noted or whatever. So I use every spare second. But when I'm running, the dialogue happens. I'm sure it happens with you. The voices are talking in your head, and I want to catch it. I have to catch it. So then there's that function on your phone where you message yourself, and it transcribes the voice note poorly. Often I have to go like, "What was that?" And then like try to figure out what it says. So I do that transcribe thing. Okay. And then when I get to my desk, I can just copy and paste that directly into the manuscript and then try to figure out where I was. Prompts to remember the dialogue that my characters were having. I think you do a similar thing, right? The voice notes.
It does.
So I'm so interested, looking back over your career, how you got from a million miles from normal to book people and all the sort of way stations in between. Do they in any way reflect your life stages at the time? I know Gail has said before that, I don't think this is still the case, Gail, but you used to write a character a few years older than yourself, like a life stage, just one stage ahead of yourself.
Oh, wow.
So were you writing your own life stages at the time, or your own interests, or your own influences? How did it evolve?
That's a really interesting question, and not one that I've really actively thought about too much. But what I do know is when I went and did my writing course, I always wanted to write a novel, and I'd never gotten past 5 pages. And I'm an advertising writer. I write 30-second commercials, 60-second commercials. And so I had this whole argument with myself. But you're a writer. You should be able to write. But you're not a book writer. You're an advertising writer. So I took a week off work and I did this writing course with Sarah Bullen. And at the beginning, she said, put up your hand if you've got an idea for a book. And all the people in the class put their hands up. And then you got your opportunity to tell her what your book was. And this was on day 2. And I told her what my book was. And she looked at me. She was very impressed, and it was literary fiction that I was trying to write.
Oh, wow.
And I told her I said, no, you don't understand. And I explained it to her again. And she was like, okay. But she said, you've been here for a day and a half, and nothing you've just explained to me sounds like you. It's not you. So she said, just stick that aside for a minute. You can come back to it. I'm not stealing your beautiful baby, your malformed baby. I'm not stealing it at all, your misconceived baby. But just for the next exercise, just have another thought. And so she gave another exercise, and that instantly became A Million Miles from Normal.
Wow.
That idea. And I wrote it in 30 days. I literally didn't sleep, didn't eat. I was like just obsessed with it. And that was much closer to my voice than the pretend playing at being an author that I'd been imagining in my mind for all these years and wasn't able to do. But that book, to answer your question, I promise I'm getting somewhere. That book isn't A Million Miles from Normal and This Way Up aren't books that I like to read. It's not a genre that I like to read, which has always struck me a little bit, and I wasn't sure why. But Sarah taught me how to write a book and to try and start to find my voice. And once I'd done that with these books, I feel like now I'm starting to write the books that I really like to read. Right. It's taken me a long time to get here. And I don't know what to attribute that to. It's very interesting to me that you were writing characters older. I'm finally writing the stuff I really love to read. And so I don't know what that means.
And at which point of your books do you think that started?
Probably Death by Carbs.
Yeah.
Maybe a little bit in Dutch Courage and Death by Carbs. But the first two was me just learning how to write a book and structure and plotting and format. And in fact, a journalist asked for my backlist the other day, and I picked up This Way Up, which was my second novel, for the first time since I wrote it. I haven't looked at it. And I read the first chapter and then told them that I didn't have any copies and hid it, took them all off my bookshelf and hid them in a cupboard because I don't know how anyone let me publish that. It was just awful.
It really isn't. I just have to say for the record, I read it and I loved it, really? but continue.
I couldn't read it. I couldn't. I haven't gone looked at A Million Miles from Normal, God help us all. But things have developed, I guess, as I've grown older. And I do think I'm writing characters that have gotten older. So I guess that's a function of me now that you've made me do some deep inner soul searching.
I've always got the impression from you, and I don't know if this is true or not, and I'm really wondering now listening to you, but that every now and then you leave writing and there've been gaps. And I don't know if it's a conversation we had where you went, no, I'm not writing.
I did. It has only been one gap.
Okay.
I finished Unprecedented.
Yes.
And that came out in 2017. And it was about Jacob Zuma. It was supposedly a comedy spoof. I wrote it while he was still the president. And I was so furious with him. I didn't know where to put my anger. So I thought, I'm going to write a book and I'm going to kick him in the head as much as I can and try and be brutal. And I imagined a future where he was no longer president, went to jail for fraud, got released early on medical parole, and then tried to become president again. And as it came out, he was no longer president, went to jail, got released early on medical parole, and then tried to come back to the presidency. And nobody wanted to read that novel because we were watching it in the news. It was too soon.
I loved that
novel. It was too soon. Well, you were one of very few people who read it. Yeah, it didn't. Of all my books, it's the poorest performing of all my books. But also something strange happened for every, I don't know, I'd be curious about you guys, but as I finish a book, I know what my next book is going to be. So as I finished Million Miles from Normal, I knew what I wanted to write next. As I finished This Way Up, I knew what I wanted to write next. Dutch Courage, Death by Carbs. But when I got to the end of Unprecedented, I didn't have a single idea, not even a seed. I had nothing for the first time since 2009. Mm. And it kind of freaked me out. But then I was also like, you know what? It's okay. Mm. Go have life. Maybe the world doesn't need another female author on the shelves battling for space amongst thousands of others. Maybe in South Africa there should be more black voices coming through now. Maybe you need to give space. And I walked away until I got the idea for Book People, and now I'm flowing again. I've written two novels since Book People, first drafts since Book People. So and then that happened again. So when I finished Book People, I knew what the next one was going to be, and then I knew what the next one was going to be. Mm. And now I know what the next one's going to be.
Really?
Yeah, so something clicked, and I can't describe it. I mean, I also went through a big breakup, and I don't know what that had to do with. You can't write. I don't know what that had to do with not writing between 2017 and maybe that was something. I don't know. Again, this is going to be an expensive therapy session. You'll send me the bill. You'll send me the bill at the end, I'm sure.
As a writer, you've done some very, very interesting things that I've been watching closely for years. And one of them, you share this with Nick Mplongo, who we also had on the podcast, which is you used to sell copies of your books from the boot of your car. You used to drive around the neighborhood with a car full of books and hand sell them. And as far as I could see, for both you and Nick, that you sold like hotcakes. It really, really worked for you. Can you talk us through that? Are there any tips you would give to someone who wants to emulate that? And also, would you ever do it again?
Yes, it does work, and I would do it again. And it's very enjoyable because you actually meet, you're literally hand selling one book at a time, but you're meeting a reader, oftentimes going into somebody's lounge. I don't know. Is it safe? I don't know. Just hope they're book people and they're not like, don't want to wear your face as a suit. I don't know. So I would do it again. The pitfall is that it's not measured. The sale isn't measured. So pros, you make more money off the sale because you buy the book at cost and sell it and you make a profit. You're meeting your readers and making lifelong connections. I delivered a book to somebody in Simonstown once. We still chat I feel like it's a friend. Mm. So you do grow your audience. Thirdly, I've met quite a few people who don't go to bookshops. They just don't. And they're not because they don't like books, or it's not part of their life or part of their routine. And they couldn't tell you where a bookshop was. And it's not because they don't want to read. They just don't get there in their life. So the thought process is, oh, she's got a book out. I know her. I was at school with her. I'd like to read that book. I'm really not going to make it to a bookstore. And back then, I'm not going to order it online because we didn't really do that until more recently. And so there are people who want to read your book, but they're not going to it. They're people by nature. We always say this in advertising when you have a competition. You have to really want to enter a competition to write what they want you to write and answer it. People don't just enter competitions. Mm. They don't just go to bookshops. They need to really want it. So those are the pros, and I'm sure there are other pros. The cons are the sales not counted. Mm-hmm. So Nielsen's, which is the aggregator, will say that you sold 500 copies, for example, when you actually sold 850 because you hand sold. Mm. So that does have an impact on your future publishing deals and on how you're perceived in the industry. Mm. And that's important. So that's why I'm not hand selling yet book people. I will, but I want to give, and also I do feel everyone needs their cut. The bookstores do deserve to make money, you know, Love Books and Book Lounge. They're relying exclusives. They're relying on these sales. So I have an added advantage and I'm taking that sale away from them. So just while it's still fresh, I'd like to give the booksellers an opportunity to make their, and the publishers to make their cut. And then I will go back and hand sell absolutely from my boot in a couple of months' time when things simmer down a little bit.
It's very time consuming as well.
Well, I don't know. You know, I fit it into my day. Okay. And then I just log, where are you? If you're in anywhere between my home and Cork Bay, which invariably you are unless you're in Durbanville, then I make my list in order of location, locational chronology. I don't know. And then I'll do my stops, you know, to have five stops on the way home from my swim. Okay. And I'm already in the car and I'm already spending the petrol, and that's a thing.
Okay.
So at any given time, I'm going to the dentist or I'm going to the whatever, you know, physio because I'm a writer and I have a bad back. We all do. So I build it into that. And some people can come to me sometimes, you know, if they're really far, far out. But you make it work. And if you can't, you don't. And then also Uber delivery is so easy. Pudo, we have more at our at our hands now than we've had before.
Very interesting.
And how do you connect with those readers to let them know that you're sort of doing a delivery run now and they must sort of get their order in?
So I'm more in control of that. So like, do you want to buy it from me? Yes, want to buy it from me in direct messages. I'll put it on Facebook and say, for example, I've got a boot full of books.
Right.
I'm cruising around. Would you like to buy it? This is the price. Mm-hmm. And then DM me, hi, I would like two copies. I'd like one copy. I'm in Simonstown. All right. Okay, well, I'm going Sunday. I'll be on your side. So you're on Sunday. Can I drop it in your letterbox or whatever? And then I control when the delivery happens. Got to suit me. But yeah, social media is so useful to reach out to people.
I can see what lies in Fiona's future and that involves driving. I want to talk to you about the Girl Walks Into experience, the co-writing experience, the writing erotica, how it started, how it felt. Tell us all about that.
Right. So for context, are co-authors of, as you guys also co-authors, so you know what that whole process is like. It's very interesting how different co-authoring processes have worked. But I wrote with Helen Moffat, who's my editor and also a writer in her own right, an incredible woman, and Sarah Lotz, who's just a phenomenal writer. The three of us wrote a series of choose your own adventure erotic novels. So it's like those kids' books, you know, but it was pornography. Basically, a girl walks into a bar, she meets a bunch of characters. If you want to go home with a rock star, turn to page 69 for want a better one. If you want to go home with the woman you met in the bathroom, turn to this page. If you want to go home with the barman, turn to this page. And then when you do go home with them, you can choose what you want to do with them. If you want to do missionary position, if you want to do whatever you want to do. And so at the time, I think I'd just brought out This Way Up, and Sarah Lotz had been in conversation with me at my launch very kindly. I'd met her twice, I think, at literary festivals, and we'd really gotten along. Mm. Helen and I had also met once or twice, again, also at the Cape Town Book Fair and the Book Lounge, you know. Mm. Sarah got a huge deal. She was one of the first writers to get a big 6 or 7 figure deal for The Three to write a book. She'd sold it on a partial, and it was a massive deal globally, and she had to write the book. And so I reached out to her and I said, I'd love to take you for lunch to say thank you for hosting my, being in conversation with me and my launch, and to congratulate you for this huge deal that you've got. And she said, can I bring Helen, my editor? And I said, of course. And we went to the food bar in Noordhoek and we had lunch. And while we were having lunch, it was around the time of the 50 Shades of Grey phenomenon. Mm. And while we were having lunch, we were talking about how in 50 Shades of Grey, she had no agency. Everything was being done to her. And it was, you know, Helen and Sarah both very much feminists. And while I was so happy everyone was reading this book and they were selling millions and reading was cool again, we were a bit annoyed that this woman was just like having this stuff done to her and she had to like it. And so Sarah said, you know, I had this idea. What if we wrote a choose your own adventure erotic novel? And I said, oh, that's like the best idea I've ever heard in my whole life. That's incredible. And we started chatting about what it would be. A girl walks in, we came up with a girl walks into a bar and the kind of structure and how we would do it. And lunch turned into dinner and they kicked us out because they had dinner and we went back to Sarah's house to sober up. And wrote notes on a tissues or something stupid. And then it was time to go home because nothing lasts forever, even something perfect. And I had to drive home from Noordhoek, which is like a 45-minute drive. And while I was driving, the first chapter was building in my head. I got home, dumped my stuff. I remember it so clearly. I lived in a tiny little flat in Gardens. I dumped my stuff, went straight into my computer, and I wrote, I think, 3,500 words or something over through the night. And the next morning I emailed it to Helen and Sarah and I was like, thank you so much for lunch. That was amazing. I've written this thing. It's really awful. Like, please don't judge me. Like, don't hate me. But I just, you know, I had to, and I wouldn't know what to do next. Like, I'm stuck. And so here it is. Okay, bye. And like, I sent it and I went to bed. And then I didn't hear from anyone for a day, or that after was a Sunday, I think. Then that afternoon, they wrote back and they were like, no, this is brilliant. We love this. And Helen was like, I know exactly what to do. Here, hold my beer. I know what to do next. And then the next morning, there was the next tranche that Helen had written. And we got like that to 5,000 words. And then Sarah pitched it to Ollie, her agent in London.
And on 5,000 words?
On 5,000 words, which we polished with, obviously.
Yeah.
And a pitch. The whole pitch. And the next two, the pitches for the next two as well, the whole series. We mapped the whole thing out. And she phoned Ollie and she told him about it. And she said there was a pause on the end of the phone. And he said, I don't know, that was either like the best idea I've ever heard or the stupidest thing I've ever heard. He said, I just don't know. I said, okay, hold on, I'll be back. And then I think that was like November or something. And then in January, we started getting these emails and they would come through at about 4 or 5 o'clock because of the timelines in America and all over the world. Every day we'd start to get these emails from Ollie to say there's a bidding war in Japan. There's a bidding war in Brazil. Oh, God. There's a bidding war. So every day would be 2 more countries or 3 more countries. And which one do you want to go with? Do you want to go with Hatchet or do you want to go with this one? Do you want to go with this one? In France, there are three publishers wanted. Which one? These are their offers. Which offer do you want to accept? And that was for like 27 countries.
Oh my God.
By the end of it. And it was very overwhelming. Mm. It became a bit like Pavlov's dog. I worked with Karen. She was across the desk and we would hear the ping at around about 4 and she would see my face and she'd go, another one. I go, another one. Read it out to her. I go, holy shit. And they just came. They just came and came. And then that was, and then we had to write 3 books in 2013 and Karen fell pregnant. And so I quit my day job. We'd been talking about resigning for a long time. It wasn't cool yet to be a woman in advertising. We'd hit a glass ceiling big time. Everyone was being promoted above us. all the men were being promoted above us, despite winning. We were winning. Mm. The year before, we'd won the biggest awards that you could win for the, we did the Alan Gray, James Dean ad. And we just weren't, were never going to be promoted. And we were ready. And Karen needed to, she needed to give birth in peace. She needed to grow babies in peace. And I needed to write this. So then we quit and we wrote The Three Girls. It was just great fun. We decided actually really early on that we weren't going to fall out. We were going to have a really good time. Sarah's very good at that. She's the, she was the mayoress of the whole thing. And she said, you know, people are going to want us to fall out because that'll be the tea. Let's not. Because of that, let's just not. And she, we were like, there are three of us, and we all decided majority rules, no sulking. And that was the process, and it was actually amazing. And each of us was so individually talented in different ways at different things, like Helen editing. I mean, you've got a world-class editor built in. Sarah at story and managing us all. I can write a sex scene, I guess. So, and Sarah wouldn't write a sex scene. So Sarah would write like this, the skeleton, and then she would write sex scene or whatever goes in here. And then either Helen or I would write that. So okay. we were just pinging it back and forth. So a very long answer to a very short question.
Amazing.
Oh, it's my favorite writing fairy story. I love, love, love that story.
I mean,
story.
It's a real unicorn. It just doesn't happen. We were really lucky. We were really, really lucky.
No, you had a really good idea.
Sarah had a really good idea, and we executed it. It was just the timing. It was also all the publishers were looking to replicate. Just everything landed.
So the other really interesting thing that you've done is – you've been published by major publishers and you have self-published, and now you back with a big publishing house again. Can you talk us through that experience, any tips you've picked up along the way, and would you ever self-publish again?
Right. So the self-publishing experience was actually a really good experience, and there was a reason that I did it. I'd published with Penguin all my previous novels, and then obviously the girl stuff, which had been internationally published, and also I think Jonathan Ball distributed locally. And I wrote Death by Cobs, which was killing Tim Noakes, at a time where banting was all the rage. And so everyone was talking about banting. It was every dinner time conversation, every queue at the bank, every shopping experience. Do you bant? Don't you bant? Do you like it? Don't you like it? Do you do the coffee with the butter in it? Like, everybody just wanted to talk about it forever, as you do with a thing. And I had this idea that somebody should murder Tim Noakes on the first page, so it's not a spoiler. And then there's so many suspects that how do the police know who to even start asking? Because he made people so angry, but also so beloved. And the book had to come out then because that craze wasn't going to last forever. And I wanted to get the Christmas sweep where everyone was buying the Real Meal Revolution for whoever. I wanted my book to be there at the same time so that you could take the piss out of your friend who was a big banter. So there was a time constraint, and traditional publishing, it can take, as you know, as you all know, a year upwards. And this book was finished in 2013. It's only coming out in 2015. These things take time. So I needed it to come out really fast. And the only way to do that was to self-publish. And what I did was I co-published. So it was mostly self-publishing, but I co-published with Bookstorm. And they manage the distribution, because it's all good and well to publish a book, but if it's not in shops for people to buy, what's the point? So I needed distribution. Because I'm in advertising and I have lovely Karen, she could design the cover for me. I hired a typesetter, cover design typesetter. Helen paid Helen to edit it. So I took on the costs and the printing, and Bookstorm took on a distribution. And then we figured out a deal based on that. The Bookstorm deal at the time was, we will take our cut depending on what you need us to do. So if you were self-publishing and you only needed them to distribute, they would take X percent. If you want them to distribute and do typesetting, they would take X percent. But you take the bulk of what you're earning off of a book, which is a lot more than traditionally publishing. And Bookstorm were amazing to work with. They were really lovely to work with. And they sold it. And in fact, that Death by Cobs was long list, came runner up in the Nielsen's bookseller Booksellers' Choice Awards of that year. It was a big seller. It sold really well. It's probably one of my better selling novels. And it was an incredible experience. And then the same with Unprecedented. It was about Jacob Zuma. It needed to happen right then and there because then I saw what was happening. Yeah. It was about to come true. And I was like, oh, shit. In retrospect, I probably should have waited. It would have been better coming out now than it would have been then. We had fatigue. We didn't want to hear about it. So I did that again. Mm. And it wasn't as successful for all the reasons that I mentioned. And what happened at the end of that was I owed a chunk, which hadn't happened on Death by Carbs because it sold. I owed warehousing fees that I hadn't been aware. Everything's a learning. This was school fees. And I got an email out of the blue to say, right, once the book had come and gone and we were through and was out of print or whatever, the bookstores had sent back what they hadn't sold. Somebody has to do the accounting. And I owed warehouse fees, which ate into the profits, pretty much took the profits. Yeah. And that was a surprise. So if you're considering self-publishing or co-publishing, it's like buying a house. There are hidden costs and it's a learning. So you have to go in knowing that you've got a cushion. Financially, you've got a cushion to cover it because it can go very well and you can make an awful lot of money. It can also not go well and you owe warehousing fees. So I loved it and I would do it again with the right title. I think a regular fiction title, I would traditionally publish first prize. But if I needed to get it out quickly or for some other reason, I would consider self-publishing again.
I think that is one of the big differences between self and traditional is where the risk lies. Traditional publishing, the publisher takes the risk. 100%. And that's why you get such a small cut.
Yes.
Self-publishing, you take the risk and you get the large cut.
You get a much larger cut. You can actually make very real money.
Okay.
You know, if you sell 500 copies, this was some years back. I think I'd worked out that if I sold 500 copies, I'd make all my money back. Or 300 copies, I'd make all my money back. And then anything over and above that was pure 100% profit. So, but those numbers will have changed now because obviously all the costs have changed. Printing paper is way more expensive. Printing is super expensive. So yeah, you can make a lot of money, but you can see your ass too.
Okay. We're going to start moving now towards your latest book because I want to ask you about the next big project in your life, which is the Good Book Appreciation Society. Can you explain what it is for people who don't know? I can't imagine there's a listener to this podcast who doesn't know about it, but just in case.
Well, just in case.
And the origin story of it.
Right. So I was working at this agency that I mentioned with Karen, and there were some like-minded book people in the agency, and quite organically, my friend Megan and I would find ourselves at her desk on a Friday at lunchtime talking about books, shoving books into each other's hands, and other people walk past, and soon we were seven of us. And we would meet every Friday at lunchtime at somebody's desk, sometimes there was cake, and talk about what we were reading. I remember one time Megan threw a Bret Easton Ellis book out the window. It made her so angry. She threw it and a car drove over it. She couldn't have it in her life for one more second. So we were very informal and fun. And then a couple of people left the agency. I got set to leave the agency and we stopped having lunch breaks. I don't know. Something's happened in the industry where advertising lunch used to be a thing. Suddenly it was no longer a thing we worked through. So we decided let's just make it a little Facebook group so that the people who've left, we can still just talk about books. And there were five members and the first post got 3 likes and we were just chatting about books. And then as with anything, social media is exponential. And I don't know how many years it is because I can't do maths, but from now we're at 23,000. I feel like we've been sitting on 23 for a long time, but we literally did just hit 23. So now hopefully we'll be at 24 soon. Yeah, so we sit at 23,000 members and we talk about books all day, all night. And it's a very happy, mostly a very happy, happy place.
And at the beginning, you had to be invited, but that's no longer the case. Am I correct?
So I'd made it a private group when I opened it because There's so many people on my timeline that aren't book people. And I was like, they're going to get so grumpy with me if I'm just, we're talking about books all the time, because it shows up on your feed.
Okay.
The algorithm hadn't quite hit in yet on Facebook. Okay. So whatever you posted showed up for everybody.
Okay.
So I thought, let me make the group private just so that it's a little safe space. So you don't have to be invited, but you just have to choose it. You have to enter. You have to search for it and say, can I?
Okay.
Can I belong? And then I'll say yes.
Okay.
As long as you're not a bot. It also avoids bots.
Yes.
Keeping it private. Yes. Avoids bots and all these accounts that have only been around for 3 weeks. I don't know if those are bots or what they are, or AI. I don't know what they are, but you can set, I've set limits. So unless you've been on Facebook for 6 months, you can't join.
Okay.
So that's also the function of stopping people coming.
Okay.
Not stopping people coming, but making it a closed space.
Yeah.
So it must have changed your life in some way, because that Facebook group of yours has become a major player in the industry, certainly in South Africa. It is so influential.
Mm-hmm.
It affects the next book that I'm going to buy. And I think it affects the next book that a lot of people are going to buy. And people in the industry have recognized this, and you must be getting approaches from publicists, publishers, people wanting you to do something for them or get behind some sort of campaign for them. Has it changed things for you in a way that is both positive and negative? What has changed for you?
It's been very organic and slow. It wasn't sudden. So it feels very second nature to me. And I would say the main difference is I get sent a lot of books, which is such a luxury and such a joy. I mean, how lucky, really. The doorbell rings every day, every second day. But it's influenced how I read.
Mm.
And I'm a little concerned about that for myself.
Mm.
I love reading and I'll read anything. But I do have to think about how much am I reading that I want to read, and how much am I reading because I hate a wasted book. To me, there's nothing worse than, I know what goes into a book. Nobody knows more. Like, I know what goes into a book from everybody's side, the publisher, the author. So send me a book. I have a responsibility to find a home for it. And they don't ask you what to send you.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm getting business books. They don't, right? Business books and motivational books and poetry books and Brené Brown, and it's not stuff that I read. But now I've got to figure out, I can't just throw them away. I have to find a way to get them to people. So that's been a big shift for me in making space in an already quite full life. And so the book show, Book Choice, is very useful for that, because we have reviewers in all different genres and I can do a delivery once a week for the different reviewers. So that's like the biggest change for me, is that people want me to read their books, which is on the one hand such a privilege that I don't take lightly at all, and I'm so grateful for it, and I never want to piss anybody off so that they don't want to do that. But on the other hand, like, I do like to read a secondhand book find that was published in 1998, or Jose Saramago, or I do like to read those things, and I do a lot less of that, which I need to autocorrect that somehow.
So obviously the idea for your latest book, Book People, came from Good Book Appreciation Society, because it is about an online book club called GBAS. I want you to talk to us a little bit about how that idea sparked, but also generally where your ideas come from. What's your, we all have a tree in our backyards where we grow our ideas and just go out and pick them when we need one. What does your tree look like?
Okay, I don't know the answer to that question. My day job is coming up with ideas, so I do it all day. And I've always said, like, ideas are like air. After I'm president, I didn't have one. I was like, maybe ideas aren't like air. Shit. So I don't know where they come from. Always somewhere different. So this book, I was thinking about how the club at 23,000, 22, whatever at the time. So I kind of started thinking, it's such an interesting space, this book club, And it's also quite contentious. There is a lot of debate and discussion, and people do leave in a huff all the time, complain to me constantly. This one said that, and this one said that, and bullying, and So I kind of started thinking it would be really cool. And my initial thought was, I should write a book called The Good Book Appreciation Society. Mm. I didn't know what it was going to be about. I didn't know anything. I just thought, that would be cool. I would want to read a book about this club where I spend 3 or 4 hours of my day every day, or 2 hours or whatever. And so then it started to spiral. So then I started to think about who, what's the tension? What's the story? Mm. What's interesting here? What can I extrapolate? What can I escalate? Where grab the popcorn? Where can I escalate? So that was kind of where it started. I'm a commercial whore. You know, with Death by Carbs, I was like, everybody's buying this Real Meal Revolution. How can I get in on that? How can I make people want to buy something? Well, maybe I'll write about that, you know.
And did it change the way you looked at GBAs? When you were in the writing phase, were you like looking at all of our book reviews and farming them for material?
No, but it's but now in the promotional phase I am.
Okay.
Now I'm looking because there's interestingly enough, there's way more contentious discussions happening on the club now than was happening when I wrote the book. Something's happened in the world. Well, lots happened
in the
world.
I think we know.
Because
of
what's happened in the world,
The
club has gotten much more contentious just in 6 months, just in the last 6 months.
I got very angry the other day.
People are getting really angry. No, really. And they're getting very angry with me. They're getting angry with each other. No, other authors have been very angry with me. But so more now, I'm like, this has really relates to the book, because at the time I wrote it, it was all quite vanilla on the page. The odd author storm out in a huff, as does, or somebody has a little spat with somebody about whether you can read Enid Blyton since she's so racist. You know, like those things. They weren't. But now it's gotten like really, I wake up in the morning and I was like, oh, not another Jordan Peterson post, please. I don't have the time to moderate this today, you know? So it's now I'm looking at stuff and going, geez, this is great promo material for the book, because it's much, I escalated the club times 1,000, and now it's not so escalated times 1,000. It's much closer to the reality of it right now.
I'm starting to think you're a bit of a prophet. You manifest things, you write about them, and then they come true.
Okay, my next manuscript's about winning the lottery. So here's hoping. Here we go.
So I want to ask about your character, Harry.
Yes.
And no spoilers, but he is the author who behaves badly in this book. And it's so interesting because I read Harry and I'm kind of shocked and disgusted by what he's doing. But also I get it. I've been that author who's been in a bookshop so tempted to turn my title face out instead of
Have you not done
face
it?
In. I've been so tempted.
But have you not actually
done it?
I've heard that the staff just go and immediately turn it back again, and that there's
maybe not immediately. Maybe they do it at the end of the day. I did it just at Cape Town International on I don't know what day it is today. I do it every time, and I fake it.
I take the book out and I pretend that I'm
looking at it,
and then I, by mistake, put it back.
Anyway, I relate to Harry. I get how he's feeling. He's all of us with no filter, and he just lets himself do these things. So did you create him with that kind of, was it an outsider's or an insider's perspective? Were you looking at how other authors behave, or were you kind of looking at your own maybe unfiltered urges?
It's both.
Okay.
It's both. There was an incident with an author. There have been a couple, but one specific has always stood in my head. A South African author got a bad review on the page, and there was some fallout from it. Her publicist phoned me, very upset. She reached out to me very upset and left in a huff, and it wasn't pretty at all some years ago. And I got quite a fright because I was involved in the review that I didn't think was a bad review but had been perceived as a bad review. Okay. I don't know if there's such a thing as a bad review. A negative review was seen as a negative review, which wasn't my intention. And it unfolded in a not very nice way that I was surprised by. You know, when it takes you by surprise. If you do something intentionally, it's one thing. But if you're surprised by it. And so that's always lived in my head. So I've written Harry from that perspective. But also the other thing is, it's actually not our fault. You can't bring out a book in South Africa, unless you're already a big name, and not promote it. You just have to. In fact, there's a debut author coming out very soon. I'm very much looking forward to reading her novel. I'm quite interested. She doesn't have a single social media profile.
Wow.
And she plans on not having one. And she's a debut author. And it's...
Let's watch that.
Yes, I'm very interested in how this is going to play out, because you need to sell 500 books. You don't know 500 people. So how is that going to work out? Facebook or social media makes you exponential. So these are, from my perspective, because I do go into bookshops and move my book around, even though I know they're going to go and move it at the end of the day. I do promote my book as best I can. And I've actually shot myself in the foot, because I've created this book group. I've written a book about the book group. And now I'm in this gray area that I can't promote my book on the book group that I've written in the book.
Well, one of the things I've always loved about the page is that it feels safe as a reviewer, that the author isn't going to, you can post a review and not have the author looking over your shoulder and commenting and taking you up on it. So another huge development in the book industry that you touch on in your book is the power of BookTok.
Oh, yeah.
And is it something that you've been following with interest? Have you tried to harness it? Will you try to harness it in the future? Where do you see your relationship with that?
So BookTok's astonishing. What a phenomenon. I mean, I was just looking at romanticy. I mean, there's a new genre. And when you used to want to buy romance, you'd walk into a bookshop and there'd be like a little in the dark corner of Mills and Boone and romance. And you, now you walk into exclusives or wherever. And they're actually, as you walk in, front and center, BookTok made me do it, romanticy, shelf after shelf after shelf. So they have changed reading 100%. I tried to be on TikTok and do some book posts. I ran out of time. Been very much in a writing phase. You do it, both do these videos. It's super time consuming. It's really time consuming. It's not just a 30-second video. What's the topic going to be? Flip. It's much quicker just to go on the Good Book Appreciation Society and review the book that I'm reading. It takes me half an hour. Whereas making a video that's, I don't know, not going to get that many likes unless I keep going and build something. I think people don't realize quite how much time these content creators are spending and what it takes. So I'm hugely respectful of it. It's changed our industry. It's made kids read. My niece is 21 and she comes here every December for holidays. In the last 2 years, I've never seen her read before. She's not that kind of girl. In the last 2 years, she shows up with 3 novels on her holiday. And it's what you've seen on BookTok. It's the Colleen Hoover, the Sally Rooney. And interestingly enough, she had Flowers in the Attic, which had been re-released, which was like this big book when we were young, how we learned about sex, I think. It's been re-released. They're rediscovering all these old books because it's a human truth. We all need to learn about this stuff. So that's BookTok. This girl who's never bought a book in her life is now bringing on holiday for a month 3 books that she's bought. Like out of nowhere. And the other thing these kids do, which is so fascinating to me, and I think it's based on how we get our content. We used to have to wait for the A-Team. You'd wait a week. Or MacGyver, you wait with Dynasty. You'd wait a week. Obviously, now we're binge-watching entire seasons all at once. And these kids are going into shops and buying a whole series before they've even read one. So they're buying 3 books or 5 books before they even know they're going to love it. It's so different to how we consume content. So it's just, I don't know. I don't even know how to process it in my head and how it can work for us. I don't know. There must be a way.
I've got one more question I want to get in. Are we running out of time? But I need to get it in. You spoke at the beginning, you talked about your dirty first drafts, and you mentioned that they're not necessarily funny the first time you write them. So I want to understand about writing humor, because your books are all, I think that is a common thread. You won't write an entirely unfunny book. And Talk to us about that. How do you get, does it happen without you thinking about it, that that's just how you write, or is it something you work on very consciously?
So it's how I write. I'm always looking for the cheap joke. Sarah once said to me when we were writing the girl book, she said, I don't know if it was when we were writing the girl books. I can't remember. Sarah once said to me, you'll write an entire chapter just to get a punchline in at the end. And I was like, yes, I will. So it's, I like the humor. I feel like it comes, well, what I consider humor, not all readers will agree. I always say I've written a comedy novel, or actually you'll tell me if you think it's a comedy novel. I've written what I think is a comedy novel. So I'll write and make it as funny as it is in the moment of writing it. And then I also read somewhere, and I remember when I'm reading books like Bossy Pants by Tina Fey, where you laugh, I literally was like laughing on every page. And I was like, God, you laugh on every page. And I had this incredible advertising mentor, Stephen Burke, and he was a genius radio commercial writer. He's the best the country had ever had. He was just phenomenal. And he had said that every line needs, if you want to write a funny radio spot that will win awards, every line needs a joke in that radio spot. You can't just, you know, I mean, there are lots of ways to do it. There are ways where you just do the whole spot and the end line is a joke. But if you want to write a funny spot, every line, and that every page needs something. So when I go back into my edit, I try and inject more humor. I try to find holes for humor, or come up with better jokes, or because sometimes your first joke or your first analogy is a bit shit or wooden. And then I'll go back. And often, I mean, the soul-destroying thing or a couple of people have written to me to tell me their favorite lines in Book People, and most of them are ones Helen Moffat's written. So there's also that, you know, having an editor, she adds, Helen and Sarah do add a lot of humor. I'm not too proud to say I'm not all the jokes are mine. They read a manuscript about a space opera, or a book about a woman, a horse who's the dead lover of her. The horse is a reincarnation of a dead lover. Yes. That's all Helen. You know, so yes, we go back later and just inject, try and make it as funny as possible.
And Paige, what have you been reading or watching or listening to lately that's made an impression?
So I don't watch very much. I have just binge-watched White Lotus like everybody else. And then I binge-watched, did you see White POTUS? From Saturday Night Live, did the spoof, White POTUS,
SNL spoof,
which was quite funny. And I also am binge watching The Studio on Apple TV, which it comes out. Also, they're drip feeding it. It only comes out every now and then. It's set in a movie studio. Okay. And Seth Rogen is the studio head. So that's all I've watched. I haven't watched anything else. Oh, I watched The Real Housewives of New York and Beverly Hills. And it's a very guilty pleasure. It's like my real trash. Like, I absolutely love it. They are my friends. If I walk past them in the street, I would think that they were my best friends. It's bizarre. And yeah, that's all I've been watching. Reading. I listen to audiobooks, a lot of audiobooks. I listened to a great audiobook called Do You Remember Being Born? You can't get it in a hard copy. And it's about a Pulitzer Prize winning poet. A 76-year-old Pulitzer Prize winning poet in America is invited to Silicon Valley to write a poem with AI. And it's written by a man. And he created AI to help him write the book. And it like just, I loved it. It's absolutely fascinating. And I also listened to The Ministry of Time.
Oh, yes.
Because I saw the book in the bookshop and it leapt out at me. It's one of the best covers ever. And I read the back several times and always put it back on the shelf. And I was like, it's not for me. Sci-fi, time travel, it's not for me. And then Helene Kutsia, my publicist at Pan Macmillan, had said, have you read it? And I said, no. And she said, you have to read it. So this is the value of word of mouth. I instantly went and downloaded it, listened to it. I loved the first three quarters of it were phenomenal. And then the end, it just fell apart.
Yes.
And I was really annoyed with myself because I reviewed it somewhere before I'd gotten to the end because I was so enthused about it. The dialogue, it was so clever. How they inhabited all those voices, just so good. And then the end, it just shat the bed.
Yeah.
Just suddenly needed to time. You found you nodding, so you've obviously had the same experience.
Mm.
And I'm listening now to All the Colors of the Dark by Chris Whitaker, which will break your heart 10 times. It's beautiful and amazing. And I'm reading, I read Khaki Fever by Lindsay Norman, which is a debut coming out. And it's for if you're a nature lover, if you love animals, she's a guide on safari, but she has no table manners. So she's very rude to the guests. You know, you're supposed to be very polite so that you can get a tip, and she can't help herself. They frustrate her, especially the American tourists, and she just blurts out bad things and loses her job. And so it's her journey. She comes back to Constantia to move back in with her folks and figure out her life, and steals a stray dog. And it's just lovely. It's a lovely, lovely light read. And Miranda July, have you read it yet? I'm about to start
all
that.
Fours, yes.
And? Oh, such mixed
loved
reviews.
Loved it, didn't love it.
Yeah, Marmite.
It's Marmite. It's very Marmite. I actually commented on a review this morning on Good Books that I felt, pull yourself together, and this is not my menopause. Huh. I highly did not relate to it.
Okay, well, you see, and that's also because you loved it, right?
I did, yeah.
So I also think people go, irate about negative reviews. There's something about a negative review that can make you still want to read the book. Mm. I want to read it to know if it's not my menopause.
I hope it's not your menopause, Paige, because if it's your menopause, I'm just sorry. Awful. You must be exhausted.
Okay. Yeah, so I've got that. So I'm really curious to see where I land. You loved it.
I did love it, yes. I mean, it is crazy. It's insane. It's the most nutty book ever. But to me, it was just so fascinating and so unfiltered and so real. And just to see a woman unapologetically putting that all on the page, I was like, wow.
So we should do a post on the Good Book Appreciation Society when I've finished reading it. Let's do a joint post where we do like loved it, hated, and whatever, wherever I land.
So Paige, we hope that everyone checks out Book People, a novel by Paige Nick. It's wonderful. It's so funny. It's refreshing. It's exactly what I needed when I read it. Mm. Gail, you loved it, didn't
also, you? Also, this is not a Marmite book. This is, if you don't like it, you're just really lacking in a sense of humor.
I quite agree. So, Paige, this has been a joy. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much, you guys.
Thank you.
Gail, we've been wanting to have Paige on the show for a long time, and even more so since we knew she had a new book coming out. And it was so much fun.
It was so much fun. And I mean, I'm going to repeat myself, but the book is so much fun. It's just so enjoyable.
But it made me think too. Yes. It really did make me sort of introspect and think about things. And she's a very close observer of human behavior and human nature.
Mm, absolutely. Absolutely. It's lovely. It's a lovely book. Everybody must read it.
Yes, it's a definite must read. So, Gail, what did you get from what Paige said?
So there were a number of things. I don't know if you saw me scribbling down ideas. I found her very inspiring in her, that passion she feels for writing when she's caught up in a project. I was very inspired by that. And because I am struggling a little bit with writing at the moment, I like that idea of the egg timer. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't have a big egg timer, but I suppose I don't actually have to use an egg timer, but kind of the Pomodoro technique.
Yes.
You know, write for 25 minutes and then take a break. And in my case, probably write for 25 minutes and then go back to whatever else is happening in the world. But I think there's really something in that when you are stuck, to force yourself to sit down and write for a set amount of time. Mm-hmm. And then, like she says, normally she continues after that because then you found your flow. Yes. So I'm really thinking that's something I might literally take home with me. Possibly not today, but tomorrow morning you may see me with a virtual egg timer. What about you?
Well, I was so interested in the advice that Sarah Bullen gave Paige that she has continued to follow to this day, which is, you have a choice. You can watch that TV show or finish your novel. Mm. You can go out to dinner or finish your novel. You can read that book or finish your novel. Basically, that you have to make sacrifices to get this thing done. And it's interesting and it's inspiring. It's not exactly how I work. Mm. So it's making me rethink how I work, because I try to have my cake and eat it. I don't put my life on hold to get a book done. I will fit it into my daily life. and always have. And it sounds as though Paige is doing that as well. Maybe when she's in what you called her editing phase, where her rewriting phase, where she's spat out that dirty first draft. And now she's building on it, punching it up with jokes, cleaning up the plot, whatever. It seems that then she's taking 10 minutes here or there, an hour here or there, fitting it around her day job. But when she's writing that first draft in 1 or 2 months, she makes sacrifices. She sacrifices her social life, her reading life, her watching life, to get this done. How did you react to that?
It's something I wrote down. And it also was a mixed resonance for me. So on one hand, I'm like you, I fit it in around what I can fit it in around. And I'm not a big sacrificer of things. I think it's part of my laziness, in fact, that I also like my life to be nice and have the things I want in it. And I don't consider watching TV or reading a book a waste of time ever. I think both of those are very valuable things. I really believe that absorbing stories in particular is very good for a writer, but also getting out and doing things. But where it really did resonate for me, and where it's something I do, is I've become very aware of the wasted time in my day, the sitting on the couch and scrolling. And then I've got into a terrible habit of, I reach a point in my day about 4 o'clock where I'm exhausted. I get hit by a wall of tiredness, and then I have a little snooze on the couch. And it really, when I wake up, I'm angry with myself. It's a waste of time. I've only got this one life. I've got all these things I want to do. I've got all these things I want to write. And I've just scrolled on my phone until I fell asleep on the couch. And that for me is where I need to be thinking like this. I need to be thinking, do you want to lie here on the couch doing nothing? And I just almost didn't say nothing. Or do you want to get another novel out? So I think I'm going to use that particular thing in those moments.
Yes, my big wasted time, which I've talked about before, was Candy Crush. And I have broken that obsession. I'm so relieved to have broken it. But I'm not filling it with writing time. I'm filling it with reading time. And to me, that is so valuable. That's how you fill up your well. That's where you get your stories from. It's how you keep your brain alive.
Yeah, I'm not going to give up reading for anything, but I do think that there is, I think that what's important about what Sarah taught Paige is that you've got to be conscious that if you want to get a book out, it takes work.
Yes.
And all the time that you're farting around is time you could have been getting that book out. So all those people who come to us, you know, Fiona, we all know it, that I don't have time to write a book, but otherwise I'd be a bestseller people.
Yes, yes, yes.
If they'd stopped farting around, they'd also get a book out. And I don't want to be one of them. I want to be a person who gets all the books out. So, yeah. I'm feeling very inspired by that.
I quite agree. So if anyone has read any books by Paige Nick, and really who hasn't, if you have read delightful new novel, Book People, and have some thoughts on it, please get in touch with us. We are on all social media across the board, and we'd love to hear from you.
You've been listening to another production from Solid Gold Podcasts.